This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. When Henry Winkler accepted his Emmy Award last September for his performance in HBO's dark comedy series Barry, he said,
"I only have 37 seconds. I wrote this 43 years ago."
Okay. The 43 years is a reference to when he was first nominated for an Emmy for his performance on Happy Days as Arthur Herbert Fonzarelli, a.k.a. Fonzie, a.k.a. The Fonz, a network sitcom version of a cool guy with slick back hair, a motorcycle, and a leather jacket who could attract girls with a snap of his fingers. Since then, he's been in movies and TV shows, including recurring roles in Parks and Recreation and Arrested Development. In Barry, which is now in its second season and just got renewed for a third, Winkler plays Gene Cousineau, a self-important acting teacher who sees himself as a wise, experienced mentor. One of his students, Barry, is played by Bill Hader, an alum of Saturday Night Live who co-created the series. Gene tries to get his students to draw on their emotional truths, but Barry is hiding his truth. He's a veteran who fought in Afghanistan and, after returning home, used the skills he learned to become a hitman. He first came to the acting class on assignment to kill one of the students. Someone else ended up taking care of that, but Barry becomes increasingly drawn to acting and wants to stay in the class and change his life. Here's a scene from last Sunday's episode. Gene is having his students tell their own stories for a show he's putting together. Barry, reluctantly, reveals a little about himself and tells the story of the first time he shot and killed someone in Afghanistan. Gene is so moved by Barry's story and so unaware of what Barry is still hiding. He tries to convince Barry to tell the Afghanistan story on stage, but Barry tries to get out of having to do it. Here's Henry Winkler as Gene Cousineau and Bill Hader as Barry.
Mr. Cousineau, I don't really have to tell the story I told yesterday in front of an audience, do I?
Of course not.
Oh, good. Thank you.
No, that version is just the beginning. See, during rehearsal, and this is just my instinct, you're going to find more complicated up details. Those we have to hear.
Right, but you know, you said that this is a story that has to define us, and I don't think that's the person that I am.
Barry, you're justifiably nervous, but I will not hear a word about switching it out one iota for something less compelling. You, sir, are doing Afghanistan.
See, I want to do a story about meeting you.
Go on.
Yeah, you know, being in this class and seeing you teach and...
So you want to tell the story of meeting me?
Yeah.
I'll allow it.
Oh, good. That's great. That's great. I think it'll be way better than Afghanistan.
I can be as involved as you need me to be in order to craft this piece, or I can stay on the sidelines. Okay. I totally understand. Either way is fine.
Okay, I don't think
but
I need
who
to...
who would know more about me than me?
That's a good point, but I don't think you need to be involved at all. You know, I was there, so I remember.
I've got scrapbooks.
Oh, cool.
If you need them. I've got diaries. I've got pictures. I've got tapes, Barry. I have got a lot of tapes.
I think I'm good, Mr. Cousineau. Thank you.
Henry Winkler, welcome to Fresh Air. You're terrific in this role. I'm so glad to have
you
on our show. So your character, Gene, is so intent on getting truthful performances from his students and have them dig deep into their souls. But he's also so narcissistic and wrapped up in the mystique he's tried to create around himself in this little class. This must have made you think a lot about some of the best and worst acting teachers you had now that you're playing an acting teacher. Have you kind of gone back to look at your past and your acting teachers?
I have. I've had about 14 teachers from Emerson College to Yale Drama School. And what was amazing is that some of them were inspirational. Some of them were mean. Some of them lost their way. And some of them had nothing to say.
What is one of the worst acting exercises you were obligated to do when you were a student?
I did an exercise with one of my favorite teachers. His name was Bobby Lewis. He was a member of the group theater. Bobby Lewis had us pick a painting, pick a character in the painting, get some element of clothing that represented that character, take the pose, step out of the pose, and create who you thought that person was. I am so dyslexic. I got my piece of costume. I struck my pose. I stood there and he said, is there any reason you are mirror opposite to what is in the painting? I said, no, I'm not. There's no reason at all. And I just turned around and immediately struck the pose in the other direction. And he started to cry. He said, you're making a mockery of my work. And I had no idea what he was talking about.
Wow, that seems really harsh.
Except that he was the man, to be honest, most of what I know, most of what I use in my well of education comes from the great Bobby Lewis.
So do you attribute this like a mirror reverse thing that you were doing to the dyslexia?
I do. I had no idea. And I, of course, had no sense of self at that time. I was an unrefrigerated bowl of Jell-O just before it congeals. I just thought, well, that's it. My career is over. They're going to kick me out of school.
And by the way, you didn't know you had dyslexia at the time.
I did not until I was 31.
And you found out at the age of 31 because...
Yes, after my stepson was tested... Because he was so verbal, and he is so smart, but he couldn't do reports. He couldn't write. He couldn't organize his thoughts. And when we had him tested, everything that they said about Jed was true about me. And I realized, oh, I'm not a stupid dog. I actually have something with a name.
How was that helpful to have a diagnosis?
The first thing, I got very angry because all of the arguments in my house with the short Germans who were my parents were for naught. All of the grounding was for naught.
You mean punishment grounded, like you're grounded.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Like I couldn't go to the dance on Friday night.
Because your grades weren't good?
I couldn't watch. My grades were horrible. I am in the bottom 3% academically in America. That is... calculated. And then I went from all of that anger to, I now understand, possibly, if I didn't fight through my dyslexia, I would not be sitting at this microphone chatting with you.
So how did you get the part in Barry?
My wife and I had just left an estate planning meeting. I didn't understand one word that the two people in the office were talking about.
That's not your dyslexia.
Yes, well, I don't know, but I really didn't get it. And all I kept saying was, yes, that sounds like a great idea. And, oh, yes, the kids are taken care of. That's good. And then we were driving down Ventura Boulevard. I got a call in the car from my then agent, Iris, who said, they want you to come in. You're on a short list. It's Bill Hader. I went, Bill Hader, Saturday Night Live. It's HBO. HBO? And then I said, okay, I'm on a short list. Is Dustin Hoffman on that list? Because if he is, I'm not going in because he's getting it. They said, no, he's not on that list. I said, okay. They sent me a script. Our youngest son, Max, who is a director, directed me in the scenes for the audition and was very strict.
Huh. So you said if Dustin Hoffman is on the list, I'm not doing it. Why did you think of Dustin
Hoffman?
He's
a movie star.
Well, there's a lot of movie stars.
He's an Oscar winner.
There's a lot of
Oscar
winners.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, we're about the same height.
Okay. So you got a primetime Emmy for your performance as the acting teacher in Barry.
Yes.
Did it take a long time for you to unfonz yourself in the eyes of the industry?
Yes, it did. Not with me, but yes. I literally thought I was going to beat the system. The Fonz was so popular in so many countries. I thought, well, this is going to be, I'm not going to be typecast. I'm going to go from mountaintop to mountaintop. And then I had a rude awakening that you don't beat the system. And it took me maybe 8 years after the Fonz to really get a good acting role. And that's when I started producing. We did MacGyver and Sightings and So Weird and directing a little bit.
I want to talk a little bit about Happy Days. How would you describe the series and your character to people too young to have seen it?
It was a story about a family, about the trials and tribulations of living together. It was set in the 50s where the music was great. And my character was a tough guy who rode a motorcycle, wore a leather jacket, and had a very soft heart.
Your character exuded confidence.
How did I do?
Good. I don't think you got to the more goofy parts of the character.
What would that be?
That
in your mind.
Okay, that he thought he was like it. You know, that he was just like the greatest, most handsome.
Well, people treated him like that.
Right.
I don't know that he thought he was, because when he, you know, the first thing I said to the producers when they called me on my birthday in 1973 and said, "Would you like to play this part?" I said, "Hey, when he takes the leather jacket off, when he takes his jacket off, who does he have to be cool for in his apartment? If you let me show the other side, it would be my pleasure to play this character."
Well, did you really, like, tell them who the character needed to be before you accepted the part?
No.
Okay.
Not. I would not tell Gary Marshall, rest his soul, who I thought he had to be. But I put the character on, and then they let me sew it onto my being.
So your character, when he was in public, and especially when he was around girls, exuded confidence, a comic confidence, but confidence.
Yes.
Confidence is something you told us you were greatly lacking in.
That's true.
Because of your dyslexia and because your father was always like punishing you and insulting you for not doing well in school, not realizing
that
it was because you had dyslexia. So what was it like for you to be this comic character who just like exuded confidence? He'd snap his finger and girls would like walk over to him.
Here's my advice. Never actually snap your finger in real life. Women will break it off.
That's good advice.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, to exemplify the kinds of things you should not say or do regarding women, we're going to play a scene from Happy Days in which you're talking about how to deal with women, and you're talking to Richie's parents here about that, and Richie's there too.
Hey, Mr. C, just take a seat. I'll tell you about women, all right? Boys,
this could be very enlightening.
Now listen, you gotta understand women. They are not real people. Excuse me, Mr. C, huh? Now listen, they expect the guy to make a pass. They get angry, believe me, they expect. But, now this is a crucial but. Let them feel that they are dumped. Pass from hand to hand, unwanted, sight unseen, and you got hurt feelings.
Maybe he's right, Dad.
Maybe I'm right?
He's wrong.
I'm wrong?
Now look, I don't want to hear any more about this. We are going to tell the truth, and I don't want to hear any arguments.
The Fonz is wrong?
Okay, some bad advice there.
Let me just say, the worst advice ever given out of a person's mouth. Especially, but you know, there were many writers. There were like 20 writers in the room, from 21-year-olds to 77-year-olds. And when we were doing this in the 70s, there was a completely different dynamic between people. Not that it was more right, it was just different. But if, you know, I now, when a fan comes and wants to take a picture, I ask if I can put my arm around them to take the selfie, because we live in a very different time with a very different expectation and level of respect.
Does some of the dialogue from Happy Days make you cringe listening back?
No, because it was what it was, and I love doing that show, and I didn't know better.
So you've told the story before about how early on in Happy Days, you were only allowed to wear your leather jacket when you were with your motorcycle.
That's right.
Because otherwise it looked too what?
ABC thought I would be associated with crime. So Gary Marshall, in his wisdom—
Because of the leather jacket, you look—
Yes.
What you look like
with it? Like a hood.
Uh huh. I mean, like, one of the people who made the leather jacket famous in movies is Marlon Brando.
Yes, that's right.
He
was a motorcycle, you know, like, thug.
What's also hilarious is considering how many leather jackets and vegan leather jackets are out there now, to think that, like, the leather jacket had such power that the network was afraid of you wearing it. That is really a different time.
It's amazing. And not only that, but all those leather jackets, from the tiniest leather jacket that the person had when they were three to the new leather jacket that they are wearing now, I have signed all of them in silver.
So I want to ask you about your parents. I don't know if they're still alive or not, so I don't
know.
They are
not.
They're not. Okay, so
your
parents were German immigrants. They came here in 1939.
Yes, they did.
So, and
through
you're
Ellis
Jewish,
Island.
So it's good they came when they did. I think
that's
the door closed
right
behind
here.
Them. Yeah. So what? How did they know to leave? I always wonder how people
knew.
Know the time is right and they'd better get
My
out.
Father knew that it was time. He got a 6-week visa from Germany to come and do work in New York, but was expected to come right back. I have told this story that he took his mother's jewelry, bought a box of chocolate, melted the chocolate down, put the pieces of jewelry in the chocolate box, poured the chocolate over the jewelry, put the box under his arm, so when he was stopped by the Nazis and they said, "Are you taking anything of value out of Germany?" He said, "No, you can open every bag. We've got nothing." And the jewelry that he encased in chocolate, he sold when he came out of Ellis Island into New York and was able to start a new life here, slowly but surely. I have the actual letters from the government each time my father requested to stay a little longer, and they would say yes, and I was born, and thank God, because I love our country.
This is the U.S. government giving him permission to stay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And you had an uncle who stayed behind a little longer and couldn't get out,
I did.
Right?
Uncle Helmut.
Mm-hmm.
And he was supposed to escape with a submarine that was supposed, you know, they had a meeting place and a lot of friends were going to get on this submarine and get out. And he said, no, I'm just going to stay one more day. It'll be fine. I'm having a white dinner jacket made at the tailor. And I think I can wait one more day and I'll be okay. And he was taken to Auschwitz. And I just did a show called Better Late Than Never, where I traveled around the world. And I saw the plaque in the street that commemorated my uncle and every other Jew that was taken from Berlin. And it said his Helmut Winkler, his date of birth, when he lived in the building the plaque was in front of, and what year he was taken to Auschwitz.
So was your family religious? Were you raised?
My family was religious. They are certainly more religious than I am.
Mm-hmm.
I am proud of my religion. My children were all bat and bar mitzvahed. But I'm not as traditional or keeping the tradition as my parents were. We said the prayer over the bread and the wine and the candles on Friday night. We had Shabbos dinner. My parents went to temple every week. My father was president of the temple.
Do you think that the Holocaust made your parents feel more strongly about being observant?
I don't have an answer to that question.
Okay.
I didn't like them so much, I didn't pay attention a lot.
You didn't like your parents?
I didn't,
is that what you're saying?
That's right. Yeah, I didn't.
Yeah.
Now, certainly, I've mellowed, but a lot of my life was fueled by the fury of these two people who were so non-present on who I was on the earth.
Do you think that your parents having gotten out just in time, your uncle having died in Auschwitz, you know, the knowledge of what happened to everybody, all the Jews who stayed behind in Germany.
Yes, yes.
Do you think that that made your father more disappointed in you and in your difficulties reading and everything? Because it's like, what do you have to complain about? Why can't you be better? Look what happened in Germany. Like,
you know what? I don't know if that is true. Listen, I figure the trauma of leaving your country, losing your family, the Holocaust of what was happening in the world at that moment certainly affected the way they were. Mm-hmm. But on the education part, the being lazy, the not living up to my potential, being a dummer Hund, which is dumb dog, I think that was in his DNA. I think that they brought that with them, with or without a war.
Henry Winkler, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so
much. Thank you.
Henry Winkler co-stars in the HBO series Barry. The second season is being shown on HBO Sunday nights. It was just renewed for a third season.
It's not true. Tell me I've been lied to. Crying isn't like you.
Billie Eilish is a 17-year-old singer-songwriter from California who's just released her debut album titled When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? She's already enormously popular on the strength of a series of singles she's released, most of them recorded at home, with her brother as her producer. Rock critic Ken Tucker says no one else in current music sounds like Billie Eilish. Here's his review.
Over a pulsing beat, the voice of Billie Eilish slides in. That voice is at once intimate, confiding, and slurry. It's hard to catch the words, but you get the gist. She's taunting a guy for being a bad guy, but then, mid-verse, she changes course, suggesting that she's the bad guy, that far from being a victim, she's a perpetrator. It's a clever, wily move, but then so much of what this 17-year-old singer-songwriter does is wily and clever. And her debut album, called When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go?, is a frequently startling showcase for her sly smarts.
Baby, I don't feel so good. Six words you never understood. I'll never let you go. Five words you never say. I laugh alone like nothing's wrong. 4 days has never felt so long. If three's a crowd and two is us, one slipped away. I just wanna make you feel okay. But all you do is look the other way. I just kinda wish you were gay.
Billie Eilish was raised in Los Angeles, homeschooled by parents who are actors. Over the past couple of years, young Billie has racked up over a billion streams for her songs of quiet angst and self-mocking humor. Pretty good for a kid who's making most of her music at home, in her bedroom, with her brother. That brother is Finneas O'Connell, an actor and musician who writes some of her work and produces most of it. The song I just played, Wish You Were Gay, is one of the singles that established her popularity. In it, she talks about a stalled romance. Rather than confronting the reasons he might not have liked her, she says she just wishes he were gay, because if so, the pressure would be off her. That is primo teenage thinking, and kudos to Eilish for being honest enough to set it to music. Another song, Zanny, may warm the hearts of parents with its anti-drug message.
What is it about them? I must be missing something. They just keep doing nothing. Too intoxicated to be scared. Better off without them. They're nothing but unstable. Bring ashtrays to the table. And that's about the only thing they share. I'm in the secondhand smoke. Still just drinking canned coke. I don't need a Zanny to feel better.
A song about being repulsed by her generation's rampant misuse of Xanax, Zanny tempts a listener to fixate on the lyrics, but the music should not be ignored. Eilish begins that song with a smoky sigh. It reminds me a little of Lana Del Rey, and even more of the Torch singer Julie London, to make a reference that might mean something to baby boomers, but will seem hopelessly obscure to Eilish and her Generation Z core audience. There's a premature world weariness about Eilish that she somehow makes enormously appealing. Her perennially poker-faced affect is a rebuke to any adult who might have the gall to tell her to lighten up. But her songs give her blank moodiness context, detail, and weight.
What do you want from me? Why don't you run from me? What are you wondering? What do you know? Why aren't you scared of me? Why do you care for me? When we all fall asleep, where do we go?
Come here.
Say it, spit it out. What is it exactly? You're paying, is the amount cleaning you out? Am I satisfactory? Today I'm thinking about the things that are deadly. The way I'm drinking you down, like I wanna drown, like I wanna end me. Step on the glass.
That's Bury a Friend, whose screechy sound effects dramatize Eilish's lyric about a monster under the bed. She and her brother like to play around with her recorded voice, distorting it, making it blur into dance pop, whose beats owe something to hip-hop in their precise rhythms.
Don't ask questions, you don't wanna know. Learn my lesson, way too long ago. To be talking to you, Belladonna. Should have taken a break, not an Oxford comma. Take what I want when I wanna. And I want you. Bad, bad news.
Billie Eilish doesn't sound like anyone around right now, partly because her frame of reference seems so vast. In addition to hip-hop and electronic dance music, she seems to be on familiar terms with folk music, soul music, glam rock, heavy metal. It wouldn't have shocked me at all if this 17-year-old had concluded her album singing a duet with Willie Nelson. Instead, she wraps it up with three songs that are the most bleak and despairing ones on the album. I don't know where Eilish is heading, and I'll bet she finds my confusion just another measure of success.
Ken Tucker reviewed Billie Eilish's new album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? Coming up, we hear from comic Rob Delaney, co-creator, co-writer, and co-star of the comedy series Catastrophe. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our next guest is comic Rob Delaney. He co-created, co-wrote, and co-stars in the hilarious series Catastrophe. All the episodes, including the fourth and final season, are now streaming on Amazon. In the first episode of the show, an American man named Rob meets an Irish woman named Sharon at a bar in London. They have a 6-day fling that becomes serious very quickly when Sharon finds out she's pregnant. Even though they hardly know each other, Rob moves to London so they can try to raise the child together. The series follows them as they get married, have children, lose parents, all the while trying to stay together, remain romantic, and not kill each other. Sharon is played by Sharon Horgan, who co-created and co-wrote the show with Delaney. He first became well-known through his really funny tweets. Delaney has since written essays about recovering from alcoholism and his bouts with depression. In January last year, Delaney's 2.5-year-old son, Henry, died of brain cancer. Soon after, Delaney had to return to comedy, writing the last season of Catastrophe. Rob Delaney spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with a clip from the final season of the show. Delaney's character Rob is a recovering alcoholic who had relapsed and gotten into an accident while driving drunk, injuring himself. In this scene, he's back in recovery and is returning from a checkup where his neck brace was removed.
So all good?
Yeah, I got the all clear. Got the clean, full bill of health. You know, she even said that my weight loss has made my penis look bigger.
Did you tell her about the bed sweats?
Yeah, she wasn't worried about that.
Really? Did you tell her how it soaks the whole bed now? She don't think that's weird and gross.
She didn't use those words.
You sure with the brown thing that just grew in your leg?
First of all, it's beige, and does it bother you that I've been declared healthy?
No, it doesn't bother me that you're healthy. It's great. It's just interesting that you could spend 40 years inhaling sausage rolls and get rewarded with a clean bill of health. That's, you know, good for you.
You should get a checkup.
I'm fine.
Well, how do you know? I mean, you look fine, but could be a mess in there.
What are you laughing at?
No, I'm just thinking, you know, one day each of us is going to go to the doctor and be told, I have extremely bad news.
Jesus Christ.
You know, I think I'm going to train for a 10K. Do you want to join me?
No.
Why?
Because you fart when you run.
Yeah, well, if you ran faster, then you wouldn't have to huff them, Slowpoke.
And that's a scene from the final season of Catastrophe. And my guest is Rob Delaney, who co-stars, co-created, and co-wrote the whole show. Rob Delaney, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Many people are going to be really upset that this is the final season of Catastrophe, myself included. One of the things I really love about the show is just having Sharon and Rob argue together, and it feels so real. And, you know, these disputes, like some of the worst ones, just come out of nowhere. Like, they're having this tender moment, like Rob is clipping Sharon's toenails, and then something, there's a misstep, and things just go so terribly wrong, and they're shouting at each other and yelling, and it's just, I mean, when that happens in real life, you're like, well, how did this just happen?
Yeah. Or you might even feel yourself in an argument thinking, oh, I think I'm about to do something stupid. And then you try to pull back, but you do it anyway. Yeah, it can really be a minefield, you know, even in a good marriage. And whenever people get, you know, if like younger people watch the show and think, oh, God, I don't want to get married after seeing that. I'm like, wait, why not? They're a great couple is what I think.
You have such a wonderful writing partner and star of the show, and Sharon Horgan. How do you two write together?
It takes us about 4 months to write a season, and we outline like crazy people. Our outlines are very long and very detailed. Then we write a very bad first draft, and then we polish it and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. And we read it out loud constantly. One thing we always try to do is have the things that we say to each other really sound like human speech. So even though we've worked very hard on them and refined them, our worst nightmare is that it would sound like, you know, written or literary.
There's a lot of sex on the show, and Rob and Sharon talk about sex all the time. And, you know, in season four, they've got two kids. They're both exhausted. They're not having as much sex. And I wanted to play a scene. Where Sharon's dad has recently died, and her mom has sort of started seeing a new man who's this senior citizen male model. And Sharon thinks that her mom's moving on too quickly. So I want to play a scene where Sharon and Rob are talking about this.
See, the way she laughed at his jokes, it was obscene. Who uses their tongue to laugh? What was that? Do you think they're having sex?
I don't know. Maybe. She still has her original hips, right?
God, I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, we barely have sex anymore, and that's fine, but not my mum's going to be doing it more than me. Maybe this is a wake-up call. Should we start making more of an effort?
I don't know. I mean, here's how I feel about sex with you these days. On paper, it sounds amazing. But if you were to initiate it, like tonight, I'd just be angry. But I still have a fond feeling when I look at you. Maybe that's enough.
Damn it, it is enough.
You know, that's a very funny scene, and it gets to this idea that's incomprehensible to young people that, you know, there might be a time where you're just too worn out to want to have sex. And I just was wondering, you know, these conversations that you're surprised you have as you get older about things that you take for granted, and in this part, it's your romantic relationship with your partner. That just seems like an interesting issue to talk about.
Yeah, and I mean, I hope that people who have kids are still having sex from time to time. You know, we're not saying, you know, that they don't have sex anymore, but sometimes, I mean, like in real life, for example, my wife and I are both reading a collection of short stories by Lucia Berlin. And so we'll be like, you know, we can be doing whatever we're doing, folding laundry or turning off the TV, and we'll look at each other and like raise our eyebrows and be like, hey, you want to go read a little Lucia Berlin? And that's like our flirty go to bed and absolutely read together and go to sleep. And that's wonderful, you know. Yeah. So, you know, it's important to have sex even after you have kids, but it's also important to do other things, you know. And yeah, your libido, you know, waxes and wanes over the years. And personally, I'm looking forward to, you know, maybe sometime around age 70 when my libido just dies and then I don't have to be, you know, led around by it.
There's not a lot of nudity on the show, but when there is, it's generally provided by you. And
yeah, I'd be tipping my buttocks. Yeah.
Yes. Were you at all nervous about being naked on the set?
Oh, definitely. But at the same time, you know, and plus I'm a big person. Like the first thing you notice when you see me among other people is he's big. And so just a big naked man is funny. And we never wanted any of the sex stuff to be – we didn't want anybody to watch it and be like, yeah, baby. We wanted people to watch it and be like, oh, God, this is – because it's just like a – it's like another body function. Like, you got to do it, you know. And so we just wanted it to be just generally, first of all, funny, and second of all, you know, uncomfortable slash awful. Plus, nudity can really stop a story short. If there's naked people on screen, I'm not really paying attention to the story myself. But if it's a big naked guy's hairy white butt, that's kind of funny. And so I'm happy to use my butt as a punchline. That might be the funniest naked part of a male or female body is a silly giant man's hairy white butt.
Well, I wanted to talk about your physicality a little bit. I mean, you said you're a big guy. You're like 6'3". Mm-hmm.
But I'm 6'4".
6'4", excuse me. Yeah, I will have to correct that. You were 6'4". But you don't come across as looming or intimidating. You kind of come across as gentle and cuddly. And I was just wondering, like, if you thought about how to use your body as a comedian as you were starting down that career.
You know, that's interesting. And I sort of think about that even when I'm just out in the world. Like, I know I'm big. I know I have, like, a heavy Cro-Magnon brow. So I know I'm scared. Like, if you're walking down the street at night and you see me, you're like, oh, damn it. And I feel bad about that. So I do try to sort of counter that with my attitude. I do try to sort of, you know, project a kind energy and a, hey, don't worry, you know, like the scary package, lovely caramel center or something, you know. So I am aware of that. And definitely, yeah, there's aspects of Rob that are like a gentle giant.
You were writing this final season in the wake of losing your son to cancer. And, you know, it's hard for me to imagine what that must have been like for you to be grieving for your son, but have to go to work and try to find humor in the world. Can you just talk a little bit about what that was like for you?
Sure. I only started to do the fourth season once I found out that Henry's brain tumor had returned and that he was going to die. And I knew I wouldn't start, but I agreed, you know, I signed up to do the fourth one. Knowing I wouldn't be able to really begin until after he did die. And the reason I did that was because I have two other kids and we have a third now. My wife was pregnant when Henry died. And I just wanted my kids to see their dad go to work, really. I didn't want to do anything. I still often don't. But I love my other kids and I love my wife, and I knew I had to sort of create some sort of scaffolding in my life that would keep me going and help me sort of fake it through, and then maybe, you know, approximate normal behavior and maybe occasionally feel somewhat normal. And it was hard. It was very hard at first to come in and work. Gradually, I started to enjoy it, and I found grief and work to be compatible. And I didn't mean that I in no way was it a distraction from grief. I don't know that I could distract myself from the grief of losing a child. But it did sort of, like, the way that I've been doing grief is I must, you know, remain sober. I've been sober for 17 years. I must, if I'm not sleeping, I still have to be in a bed for 7 or 8 hours a night. I force myself to eat. My wife and I force ourselves to go on the odd date so that our kids have, you know, their parents have a relationship and they know who each other are so that they can lean on us. So so work was a part of that. Cause I needed to put a support system in place so that grief could work through me and not kill me, you know? Because if you lose a child, you know, part of you is like, oh, well, why the hell am I here? You know? Cause parts of me wish that they were dead and wish that they were with Henry, wherever he may be, you know? Like, I don't fear death anymore. I'd like it to happen a long time in the future because Henry's illness and disability and death and being without him has not made me love his brothers any less or his mother any less. And I want to be here with them. But when it comes time for me to die, I'm going to tap dance. But yeah, I mean, I have like a significant portion of me is lives in another realm now, and is with him.
Did you find support in the people that you worked with on the show?
Yeah, so in the room is Sharon, of course, and then our writing assistant, Chrissy Ducker, who's also wonderful and was with us for the third and fourth season. And so I just start crying at the desk, and then they'd start to cry. And they'd sort of take a cue from me as to when we could start up again. And by doing that, by sort of grieving at work in front of everybody, I don't know, it created sort of a more honest, healthy environment for us to work in, you know? And amazingly, we were writing a comedy, a joke-heavy comedy throughout this, which is insane. I mean, I still can't believe that.
Rob attends AA meetings on the show. You've been pretty open in the past about your struggles with alcoholism. And it sounds like in your memoir, you wrote about this, that you were trying to stop drinking for a while, but just couldn't. Yeah. And then you had this just terrible car accident where you blacked out. It seems like you would black out a lot when you're drinking. And
I did.
You rammed a car, not your own car, into a like a municipal building in L.A., and what did you break? How many limbs did you break?
I broke my left wrist and had to have surgery on that. I broke my right arm and had to have surgery on that. And then my knees, neither of them were broken, but they were the skin, they were ripped open to the bone. So I had surgery on all four limbs, but only two of them were broken.
You said you were the most messed up person in your rehab house. And so you were kind of
physically,
like, physically. And so you were like the mascot.
I mean, because I was the type of person you could see from across the street at night while it was raining out and be like, oh, he has problems. Whereas other people might have had an easier time hiding them. And I'm so grateful for that. In fact, the line in the first episode of season four where Rob says to Chris, you know, I realized that my drinking could kill other people. That's just something I would often say when I was first getting sober, because like a lot of alcoholics, I didn't care if I died, but I didn't want to kill anybody else, my God. And so when it was really driven home for me that my drinking could and likely would kill other people, then it made it much easier to stop. I guess not easy, but maybe simple, because there was no other choice.
You moved to London to do the show, and do you think the UK audience responds differently to the show than the American one?
Not anymore. I think in the beginning, when we would really put Sharon and Rob through the paces, there's a more sort of fatalistic streak in British people, or a more resigned quality where they'd be like, ah, yes, of course, another terrible thing has happened. Yes, why would we have expected otherwise? Whereas in America, people would be like, what? I tuned in for a sitcom. They can't do that. They're yelling at each other at it's the last episode. Why aren't they tying it up in a bow? And but now, four seasons later, Americans, they now know how we operate. So there's more, I'd say, parity in the response between the two places.
Rob Delaney, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for everything. I appreciate it.
Rob Delaney is the co-creator, co-writer, and co-star of the comedy series Catastrophe. All four seasons are streaming on Amazon. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.